The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, a very good morning. How are you?
Okay, Tov, all good. Thank you, Howard. Ready to roll.
Indeed. So let's get straight to it. The government has halted the easing of lockdown restrictions as a result of the continuing increase in new cases of COVID-19. All right. So what restrictions were due to have been eased and have now been postponed?
So, you know, just to let people know, we're going to have to continue to talk about coronavirus because it is certainly dominating the news, and I know that a lot of us are kind of tired of it and had enough of hearing about it, but unfortunately it's something that is dominating our lives and unfortunately seems destined to dominate it for at least the foreseeable future. In the case of the Israeli government, Prime Minister Netanyahu announced yesterday that he is pulling the emergency brake, as he termed it. And by that he means not necessarily going back to lockdown or any form of lockdown, but rather stopping things that were due to have been eased in the coming days. Ironically, the one thing that he didn't stop was to allow event halls to open and to increase the number of people who can attend events that are being held at these locations. Up to 250 people apparently are now allowed legally to attend public events, family functions, celebrations and things like that, according to rules which are due to be published apparently in the coming days. So event halls will go ahead. But for example, the dreaded train service has been delayed again. And as I said yesterday, this is a real kind of indication, a little bit of a window view into a little bit about what's happening in Israeli society at stop start. In the case of the train, it's definitely stopped. No trains are due to be online anytime soon. Apparently we might well be in for further restrictions as time goes on. Interestingly, quite a number of those schools that closed down due to the fact that people were infected there have now reopened. There continues still to be quite a large increase in the number of people who've been diagnosed with the coronavirus. Yesterday, 169 Israelis were diagnosed with the virus. New cases were diagnosed. Tel Aviv apparently is the current hotspot where the virus is growing at the fastest level. And so obviously there's some concern about that. There are also new patients. There were new patients in Jerusalem and even in the city of Sderot. As many as 16 new diagnoses coming from Sderot. What I also found interesting vis-a-vis the whole coronavirus situation is that the survey, the rankings have been published again for those countries that are considered to be the safest as far as corona is concerned. This is a risk assessment and a survey that's been conducted by the Deep Knowledge Group. Originally, we might remember that the previous time the survey was produced, Israel was actually the top-ranking country. Now Israel has moved down into third place behind Germany and Switzerland, even though both Germany and Switzerland have had significantly more cases of the coronavirus than Israel. But apparently, it's based on a number of different things, not only the number of cases who have been confirmed, but indeed now the whole area of easing the lockdown becomes quite influential in how this survey looks at the various countries. Interesting, for example, New Zealand, which has zero active cases, and they've succeeded in absolutely eradicating corona from New Zealand, having had, I think, 20-odd people die and quite a few cases of the virus diagnosed. But they are only ninth on the list, and even behind China and Australia, which was an interesting assessment. Israel is third in the first tier, obviously. There are about 10 or 15 countries that are considered to be tier one. I noticed, interestingly, that South Africa is considered to be in tier three of these countries. A lot of different issues come into play here, not only how people are being treated from a medical perspective and how people are being diagnosed, the number of tests that are being done, but also relaxing the lockdown and economic help that the government is offering, how the government is allowing the economy to get back to work. And I think that that's where Germany and Switzerland have been allowed to move ahead of Israel, because they seem as if though the way that they've returned back to work has been more efficient in the view of these authors than the way that Israel is working. But nonetheless, a new factory has been inaugurated down south in the city of Sderot to produce N95 masks, high quality N95 masks, Israeli blue and white production. So that's a factory that not only gives jobs, but hopefully will also secure masks for the foreseeable future for the Israeli, for Israeli society. So a lot of work going around the coronavirus issue. And as I've said before, this is something that we're going to have to continue to be on top of and to talk about, at least for future.
And people returning to work after lockdown outnumbered those that are losing their jobs by 10 to 1.
So this is a very important statistic and a very pleasing one, because all of those people who were, sorry, not all, but many, many people who went into lockdown and had to stay home were put on leave without pay. Okay, and that was a very, very simple thing for businesses to do, to send people home and say, we're not going to pay you while you're at home. We'll see what happens afterwards. And the government did deploy some sort of an economic program to allow people to have some income while they were at home without pay. But of course, there was a huge concern that many people sitting at home without pay would ultimately become unemployed because there would be no business to go back to. And now we're seeing, as you said, a ratio of 10 to 1. People who have returned to work outnumber people who are without work by 10 to 1. 56,000, nearly 57,000 reports of people going back to work over the past week, whereas only 6,000 new job seekers. So I think that's a very pleasing statistic. But I suspect that a lot of businesses will then start up after the lockdown and find themselves unable to continue due to the different economic circumstances in which we find ourselves. And a surprising number of offices still remain empty, with people working from home rather than coming back to the office, even though according to the rules, everybody is now entitled to return back to work, but obviously with the relevant social distancing being employed. But a surprising number, really a surprising number of offices which have either remained closed or which have given people the option to stay home if they so wish. The office is open and pretty much empty, people not even turning up.
It is interesting, but it's good to know that hopefully things will get back to the way it should be. The prosecutor at the International Criminal Court has decided that Israel has a case to answer for war crimes in spite of the existence of the Oslo Accord.
So this is a story that we've been following already for some time, with the International Criminal Court prosecutor Fatou Bensouda, a central figure in all of this, and we've spoken about her and her views about Israel in the past. The last time the court met, the court asked the prosecutor to go away and form a position about the relevance of the Oslo Accords to this case that has been brought by the Palestinian Authority against Israel for war crimes, particularly that relate to wars that have taken place, operations that have taken place in Gaza, dating back the last few years, the last number of operations that have taken place in Gaza. And Israel has been asked to answer to these charges of war crimes. But of course, the status of the Palestinian Authority in front of the International Criminal Court has been brought into question, and whether Israel has the, whether the Palestinian Authority has the right to accuse Israel of war crimes, seeing as a so-called state of Palestine doesn't actually exist. And so, Fatou Bensouda, interestingly, has come back saying that even though the Oslo Accords do apply, in spite of that fact, Israel still has a case to answer of war crimes relating to Gaza operations back in 2014, and also some of the things that have been going on in the West Bank in 2018-2019. And the real question is, what is the relevance of the Oslo Accords to this particular legal argument? And the answer is that the Oslo Accords said very specifically that a state of Palestine would not be brought into existence in terms of the Oslo Accords. However, that it could be brought into existence through a negotiated solution. That was the main crux of the Oslo agreements. Of course, the Oslo agreements also divided the Judean Samaria area into areas A, B, and C, which are in existence and very much part of our reality today. So if you want to sweep the Oslo Accords completely aside, then you need to take away areas A, B, and C and everything else was that was encapsulated in the Oslo Accords. And so what's happening now is, of course, that people are picking and choosing which elements of the Oslo Accords they really want to keep in existence and which ones they wish to sweep aside. But if you take the Oslo Accords as they are, then the state of Palestine does not exist and therefore cannot have legal standing in front of the International Criminal Court. Ben Suda has come back to say, even though the Oslo Accords do exist, she believes that Israel will have a case to answer and that effectively the state of Palestine, in inverted commas, is a valid party to the International Criminal Court. So it's an interesting aspect because the Palestinian Authority had to also be very, very careful because in the last few weeks, the Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas has made statements saying that he will cancel the Oslo Accords if Israel proceeds with this annexation that's being discussed. But of course, if he cancels the Oslo Accords, then he effectively does away with everything that the Palestinian Authority is about today, because all of that was brought into existence through the Oslo Accords. So we've got a classic case here of picking and choosing, deciding which bits are relevant and which bits are not relevant. And unfortunately, that's now been confirmed by Fatou Ben Suda's decision at the International Criminal Court. That's not the end of the story. Israel does have a right to appeal this particular decision. It's not clear yet whether Israel has decided to appeal it or not, but we will keep watching to see what happens next.
Yeah, really, really interesting. The other thing that I thought was fascinating was that a poll has shown that more than half of Israelis support the idea of annexing parts of Judea and Samaria. Can you just before we even continue, which parts?
Well, I haven't actually seen a map of which parts are due to be.
Because there seems to be a lot of very little information being shared with the Israeli public.
Well, I think that what we generally understand without seeing particular maps and without seeing particular borders being drawn is that effectively the areas of Judea and Samaria that are currently inhabited by fairly large populations of Israelis will become part of what's effectively annexed under this plan. So that would include Ariel, that would include Gush Etzion, that would include Ma'ale Adumim, and would include various other bits of land as well in between, where there might be pockets of Jews who are living, who have been settled there under government plans completely legally, whereas the Arab villages and the areas around the edges would effectively then form part of Palestinian Authority and potentially a future Palestinian state if things go that far. So although I haven't seen a map, I think there's a fair kind of expectation about which parts of Judea and Samaria will fall on this side of the fence and which ones will fall on that side of the fence. And I was quite surprised to see that this poll that was undertaken by the Israel Democracy Institute found that 50.1% of Israelis, just a simple majority, actually supported the idea of annexation, whereas only 31% actually opposed it. Here's the interesting bit, though. Something like 25% of Israelis would support annexation even if the U.S. government doesn't support it. So that's an interesting point, and I think that this is really all about finally getting to a border that we can point to that is accepted somehow by the international community, that is not a moving feast, a border that we can say, these are the borders of the state of Israel. We'll draw them not in pencil, but we'll draw them in very, very, very thick black ink so that there can be absolutely no doubt as to where our borders are. And we can set up our defense systems accordingly and, of course, border crossings to match that. So just an interesting little piece that is aside from what's happening with Corona at the moment.
Yeah, and it is good to be able to talk about other things.